Good evening and welcome to this evening's Big Tent live events discussion. My name is Wes Williams and I'm the director of Torch, the Oxford Research Centre for the Humanities, jointly presenting this evening's event with St Peter's College. Big Tent live events is Torch's live online event series and forms a key part of the Humanities Cultural Programme, itself one of the founding stones for the future Stephen A. Schwarzman Centre for the Humanities that's coming soon here in Oxford. As regular viewers will know, the HCP has curated a series of cultural debates, discussions, and performances online since the very first lockdown. We hope that you are all keeping as safe and well as you can be during these difficult times. This evening's session is, as I say, jointly presented by the HCP and St Peter's College, Oxford. And so I'm pleased to welcome first to our screen the Master of St Peter's, Professor Judith Buchanan. In her academic life, Professor Buchanan is also an early modernist, as am I, in fact, although I'm in French, Judith is more in English, specifically a Shakespearean and a scholar of silent film. She works frequently and productively with a range of creative partners across arts and heritage sectors, both nationally and internationally. Judith will be the interlocutor with our guest speaker in this evening's discussion. Welcome, Judith. And welcome to our guest speaker this evening, Ken Loach. Ken, who I hope is, there we are. Ken is not only a St. Peter's College alumnus, he studied law here a good few years ago, but also a multi-award-winning filmmaker, writer, and director for television. His films testify to a deep concern for social justice. His pioneering work extends all the way from Kes and Kathy Come Home in the late 60s through to Sorry We Missed You, released just over a year ago, a trenchant critique of the so-called gig economy and its effects on the precarious lives of people across Britain. Tonight, Ken will be discussing his approach to filmmaking with Judith, and together they will focus on two of the films in particular, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, from 2006, and I, Daniel Blake, 2016. I will now disappear from the screen, sit back, watch, and listen before joining you again for questions towards the end of the hour. Please do post any questions you might have in the chat on YouTube as the discussion progresses. For now then, without further delay, over to you, Judith.
Thank you, Wes. Before we kick off, perhaps I can start with a word from St. Peter's College. It's the college of which I'm deeply proud to be master. In fact, it's your old college as well, Ken. We set up as advertised to be a conversation about two or three of Ken Loach's films. It was a fairly modest, but a detailed conversation that we had envisaged, a conversation that might well, we thought, appeal to those with an interest in filmmaking and Ken Loach's significant and distinctive filmmaking in particular. It was intended as a follow-up conversation to several others that Ken has had with Oxford students and St. Peter's students over the years, all of which have been extremely well received by students. So in issuing the invitation, therefore, we had not foreseen controversy. We have got it, and I understand why. As part of this, there have been many calls, both from within and from without, for this event to be cancelled. Neither St. Peter's College, nor Torch, nor the university believes that no platforming is the way to pursue goals of a free and open academic community. We oppose the delimitation of intellectual or cultural engagement within the law. A university's role in this respect could be a discussion for another day, but it is not the advertised discussion of today. And we are committed absolutely to allowing for questions, but having the discussion that has been advertised first. And I would say, by way of quick aside, in ways that will, I fear, be mysterious to some but intelligible to others, that we have begun an important conversation within St. Peter's across this last weekend, and we are committed to taking many of those important questions forward and for learning lots from them institutionally as we do so. As always, in my engagements with students, I know I will. So as we launch into the discussion that we have advertised, been advertised as having, let me add now my own word of welcome to those of you watching on YouTube And Ken, thank you for being with us. We're going to start by talking about The Wind That Shakes the Barley, a film that was released in 2006. I'm sure that many people will have seen it, but not everybody will have done. Can you just give us a sort of outline idea of the film's story?
Yes, Judith, thanks so much. It's always a huge pleasure to be at St. Peter's, even though it's a virtual presence today. And thank you for your invitation, and thank you for your strength and determination that this friendly chat should continue. The Wind That Shakes the Barley, we made it 2005, I think 2006. And it's a film that Paul Laverty, the writer, and I had wanted to make for some time. It's about the story of the War of Independence that Ireland fought in 2019, 2020, and then the subsequent Civil War. The War of Independence is, to us, was the end of a long colonial struggle. And that interpretation of history caused some discussion. The opening scene that we're going to see is the raids by British forces to an Irish family, an Irish farm, homestead. And there's the lads in the neighbourhood have been playing hurley and they've been engaged in the game. That was against British rules. You weren't allowed to meet more than two or three people together. So this broke the rules. So they went back to the farmhouse. They were just saying goodbye to each other. And the tans, the black and tans arrived, the British forces arrived, and we'll see what they do.
So this is set in 1920?
Yes.
Perhaps you could play the clip for us now then, Ambara, so we can get a flavour for it. The frame rate might be a bit jumpy.
Hello, Sinead.
Damien, when are you off?
The weekend.
I wish you all the best.
Thanks very much.
Mind yourself now.
I will. Right.
God will protect you, son. I know he will.
Thanks, Peggy.
Right. How many times have you bastards, you mick bastards, been told, eh? Defence of the realm act. Do you understand? All public meetings are banned. And that includes your cocky little games. Do you understand? Check the details. I want names. I want addresses. I want occupation.
Name?
Conor Sullivan.
Louder!
Conor Sullivan. Ballingeary. Ironmonger. Name?
Chris Riley.
Louder!
Chris Riley.
Don't look at me, boy.
Reeves Estate. By the crossroads. Farm labourer.
More like a prick. Don't grin at me, you bastard.
Name?
Luke Dunn.
Name?
Mihala Sullivan.
What's that shite? He doesn't want riddles. He wants your name in English. Tell him. Shut the fuck up. Tell him.
It's Quaker man, Mihala Sullivan, force it.
Bit of a comic, me boy. He see me laughing. Well, laugh at this. The lot of you, strip off. No, shut up,
officer,
you bitch.
Officer,
shut the fuck up. Move. I mean, fucking strip.
Get up there!
Get up there!
So you're 17 year old athletes doing nothing!
Shut up! Shut up!
17 years of age, Michael!
Nothing done, Sarge.
Right, lads. Dad, back it off.
Oh, big brave man, aren't you?
Oh, sweet Jesus. Oh, Jesus.
Take him down.
Mihal!
Mihal!
Mihal! Mihal! Mihal! Put the ropes off, Mihal!
Oh, Jesus! Mihal! Oh, Mihal! Oh, no!
The new that made me think an island eerie, while soft the wind blew down the glen and shook the golden valley. 'Twas hard to fearful words to frame, to break the ties that bound us, but harder still to bear the shame of foreign chains around us.
Ken will be back with us in a moment. Ken, yeah. It's a traumatic piece. It's brutal, it's edgy, it's energetic, it's unnerving. And the rhythms matter, and the rhythms for you often matter within a scene, and they also matter across a scene, but that there's also something about the ensemble feel there, which is quite remarkable, and there's Cillian Murphy in the middle of it. How do you allow your actors to find that space together without the fact of the camera somehow inhibiting that kind of level of sense of the urgency of them being in the moment?
It's in the preparation, it's in the casting. The soldiers, for example, were ex-soldiers from Britain. Tom Charnock, the sergeant, sadly died just recently, but they were all ex-soldiers. They came and they stayed separately. They didn't meet the Irish lads until the scene. They came in. Some of the lads knew the script, Damien and the ones who were expected to speak knew the script. Some of them weren't prepared. So the instruction was, look, just obey orders, whatever happens, just fit in. And obviously we do one or two takes so that it builds up. For the Irish young men and the family, they had to feel like they were people living on the land. They were part of that landscape. They weren't visitors. So one or two of them are actors. They're all from County Cork. So they all have the same dialect, the same accent. They use words in the same way, language in the same way. When they were cast, some were just ordinary lads, apprentices or farm workers. One or two of the best characters were just lads who worked the land. Cillian obviously is a very experienced actor. The Ironmonger was a lovely man, an actor. So four or five of them were actors. The mother, the older woman, is an ordinary woman, but an amazing presence, a wonderful woman. And the younger woman is the very young woman is an actress. The middle-aged woman was a teacher. But we find them with a careful, very careful selection, meeting, chatting, trying things out. And then the prep was probably 10 days or so, working together, learning to play a flying column, which is how the Irish fought the war, with guerrilla tactics in the countryside. And they learned how to be guerrilla fighters. And they got to know each other. So a lot of jokes appeared, you know, the banter, the crack. So that was developing, but they didn't know who was going to get killed. So that shock. So I think the key, to summarize, the key is to let something real, as real as you can, happen in front of the camera, so that there is an air of surprise and energy and what's going to happen and shock. Because you can't, once you know, if you'd rehearsed that, you've killed the shock. And it depends on shock, and it depends on outrage, and the sense that this is just not right. And of course, they killed him. They killed. And when we were preparing the film, there were so many stories in the folklore of people around who knew about this. And we would be taking the field and say, that's where the Brits killed so-and-so, and that's where they chased so-and-so, and he got away. And evoking that folkloric memory was one of the most exciting things of the film. And the sense of justice in what they were doing as well was so important. So it's the event that turns Damien, Killian's character, into the leader of the flying column. But it's, as they say, it's gardeners say it's in the soil. For filmmaking, it's in the preparation. The film, the sequence of shoot was very quick. 2 or 3 hours, you know, we'd done it. But it's in the present, it's in the preparation and the expectation.
Your process with actors is very particular in that, because yes, you are not giving them a full script. You're not telling them necessarily what's going to happen in the scene when the cameras are rolling. Mm-hmm. So in order to be able to catch something that feels unlearnt, mm-hmm, unscripted, unprepared, it hasn't been over-intellectualized ahead of time or tried out this way, tried out that way, you are actually looking for something that is raw and real and unschooled. And that repeatedly we see you getting that, but it's a process that is, it requires a certain kind of actor trust, doesn't it? That in yes, order for them to feel comfortable being put into a situation with cameras rolling without quite knowing what might ensue within the scene.
Yes, not every scene is like that, of course. I mean, you know, some scenes are quite long dialogue scenes, and then obviously people know that they have that, so if you know, however long before that they need it, so that they're comfortable with that. But we still try and break it up a bit or throw something in a bit different to the dialogue. But it's, and also the kind of rehearsing we do is a mixture of, well, it's mainly improvisation, the rehearsing, so that they're very comfortable with doing it and having things thrown at them, so that if you began that on day one of the shooting, it wouldn't work. There's got to be that facility there. And for the soldiers, you know, the sergeant had the outline, but the others, we said, look, you've been in the army, you've been in these situations. Some of them had served in the north of Ireland even. So it was, again, it was like their own history. And that was the reference I always used. You know, I said, what did you ever do anything like this? How did it work? Could we talk about that in advance?
And in managing the moment, in order to be able to make good on the raw that you have set up as possible, you don't say action and you don't say cut. You're not, yes, wanting to frame that moment as somehow separate from something else. Tell us about that.
Yes. No, they're killer words, really. I mean, the moment you say action, everyone, you know, jumps, and it's not creative. No, you talk about, you get people prepared, you give them a little clue, just a little word, or maybe you don't need to say anything. Often silence is the best form of direction. Okay, off we go, or turn over to the camera, just signal to them quietly in the sound, and then say, okay, Tom, in this case, the sergeant, and then he's got the initiative to start the scene.
Names are so important, aren't they? We've just seen a 17-year-old in this scene be killed for refusing to say his name in English. You've got the men with their arms in the air being shouted at to say their names. And then later that kind of band of brothers and community get caught on different sides and they end up in firefights against each other. And even within the firefight, because they have such shared history together, they are calling each other's names in order to appeal to them to stop shooting or whatever. The kind of intimacy of the use of names presses quite hard on this film, I think.
Yes. Yes, I hadn't thought of it like that, but no, I think you're right. I think that comes instinctively from the people playing it. I mean, it's important to say that Paul's script is very precise, and the trick, if it's a trick, or the problem really is to marry what is a very precise script, and something Paul works with on very, very closely. And we work together on the project, but Paul does the writing. And 95% of what is seen is are Paul's words, and the issue for the director is to bring those words to life, and allow the whole presence to breathe, and for the people in the film to feel they have done it, it's theirs, they own it, and they can do what they like. But actually, it's like I often say, it's like digging a trench for a street for water to run down a hill. The water doesn't know it's being guided, but it is. And it, if it works, it's like that, that you set it, the scene up in such a way that that will happen, and Paul's words will just emerge. And obviously in the scene we've just seen, I mean, the soldiers are throwing stuff in to respond, but that's fine. But in most of it, and even there, the sergeant's words are mainly Paul's words. And Michael O'Sullivan, Michal, Damien, Killian Murphy and the others, they're Paul's words, even in the midst of that mayhem. But the presence of an army of occupation there, you know, has many, in a way that every war is different, but every war has things in common. And the presence of a brutal army of occupation evokes many, many comparisons.
So you were talking about Paul Laverty, the writer. We're not quite ready to move on to the next film yet, but in a moment we will be doing, and we're going to move on to I, Daniel Blake, a film from 2016 when we do, which Paul also wrote. And actually, Paul is a regular collaborator with you, and George Fenton is a regular collaborator with you, the composer. And you actually have a kind of core team that you quite often work with. How does that then enrich or speed up the process of how you speak with each other about the evolving and collaborative process of filmmaking, that actually you have a kind of intimacy of understanding of process with each
other? It goes back to the heart of filmmaking again, because the paradox of filmmaking is that it is the result of a contribution of many skilled people. Camera, sound, design, continuity, editing, music, many and others, many skilled crafts. But yet it must, I think it has to have one voice. And that's in a way where the whole French idea of the auteur arrived, which I don't subscribe to, but I see where it comes from. Because most commercial films, pretty well all commercial films, are very highly skilled people just doing their thing. But there's not the sense of that unique, a single vision. So to find a team where everyone of their own volition enjoys that particular aesthetic, that kind of framing, that use of light, that sense of natural sound, the sense of rhythm in the editing that is like your eye, not like you're being twisted to look at this, look at that, look at the other, but a kind of unfolding of something as if you were an observer. A kind of performance in which it doesn't have to be overstated. Things don't have to be underlined. Music that doesn't underline the melodrama, but just as a supplementary voice somewhere saying, putting another perspective. All those things, the design is the one craft that disappears completely. If it's good, it's not designed, it's just there. And yet it's immensely subtle, the choice of colours, the choice of background, so that it enhances the people in front of it. You shouldn't notice it, but it should work. So finding that commonality of a group of people where we learn from each other is absolutely central, because then you have one vision, and that's what's really exciting in the process.
Something That kind of reminds me of your cinematography as well, in that there's something kind of very self-effacing about it, that is, it is, it's doing all sorts of interesting things, but it is quite keen not to draw attention to itself in order to let the story tell its own pith without a sense of the process of its creation getting in the way of that. How do you tread that careful balance between actually it being quite, quite beautifully and carefully composed, and yet not overdrawing attention to itself as the mechanism of the telling in the process?
It's down to several things. First of all, the guiding principle is that the camera is an observer. The camera is another person in the corner of the room, the corner of the field, from a distance, wherever it is, wherever it's appropriate, it's another person. And so the choice of position depends on a number of things. It depends on where's the light, that's the first question. So you don't want to shoot with the light behind you, because that flattens people's faces, and it also is not very sympathetic. And you want the audience to engage with the characters, so you have to light them in a way that is draws you towards them. It's about recognizing common humanity is the idea beneath it, the idea of solidarity with the characters in a way. So it's a camera position. It's the light, so that they're lit in naturally, but the camera position finds that right angle where the natural light is coming one way, and you find the position in relation to the people that lights them in that humane, empathetic way. Then it's the lenses, very important. The lenses reflect the range of the human eye. So, but before I leave the position, something else to say is that sometimes you see films with, and the camera's on the floor. Well, why is the camera on the floor? No one's going to be lying on the floor looking at this. Why look from the floor or up from the ceiling? Why is the camera on the ceiling? Who's on the ceiling looking down? You know, there's an internal logic to it that people, I hope, aren't aware of, but there is a sense of humanity in the way we're looking at it. And then the lenses correspond to the range of the human eye, so that if you're in a room, you can see a certain width, so that's the widest you'll use. And if you look hard, you can actually see, you concentrate on someone's face or whatever. And that's the lens we use. But you're never that close to people that you're in their space, you know? Because that just seems disrespectful. And again, not something you would do.
But also,
so it's to do with those things.
So you're actually keen not to dehumanize the perspective, that the point of view shot is feasibly a human one.
Yes. Yes, and absolutely. And it's reflected in the editing where you cut when your eye would move. And you don't know who's going to, say you're in a room, you don't know who's going to speak next. So you've got to have a sound cue, something, or a look, or something that prompts you to look at that person.
Mm. So the scene we just...
Again, it's like the human eye.
The scene we've just seen is a fairly fast and frenetic edit. And yet we're not really thinking about that as a, obviously the more edited it is in some ways, the more obvious its construction is. And yet one is so taken up by the urgency and the drama of the action, as one should be in such a film, that one is not really clocking the editing. But in relation to that the freneticism and the awful, awful energy of that scene, there are a lot of ensemble scenes which have a kind of urgency on them in terms of action, but also in terms of what the editing is feeling like. But there are also some really key two-hander scenes, a one-on-one scene where it's a quiet and an important conversation between two people. So I'm thinking of the Damien Sinead quiet moment when they're on a short walk and he says, "I can't feel anything anymore," or something of that sort, because this sense of kind of nerve endings being deadened by the struggle that he as an individual finds himself reluctantly, but with conviction, caught up in, or the intensity of the intimacy of the two brothers outside the church when Tony says to Damien, "I can't do it without you," or the very final moment of those two brothers' encounter just before, spoiler alert, Damien is killed, in which there is so much history and sense of what might have been, the romance, the future, the children, the grandchildren that might have happened for one, the professional aspirations of being a doctor, all of which has had to be sacrificed, and the kind of the loss of the individual aspiration has gone. But how you shoot those scenes is extraordinarily poignant and very different from how you shoot those energetic ensembles scenes. And it plays to what you're just saying about trying to humanize it, but also trying not to get in the way.
Yes, yes. I mean, the writing is beautiful in that. I mean, he's a wonderful writer, Paul, and it's been my great good fortune to work with him for nearly 30 years now. And we're like Morecambe and Wise, really, you know, because of dear double acts. We shoot very simply. I mean, we shoot really quickly. The whole film, I think, was 6.5 weeks, you know, which in film terms is pretty quick. But as you say, that the key thing is what's happening between the people, so that you and we don't do it over and over again. You know, I never tell people how to say things. It's how it's them in that scene. It isn't them playing someone else. It's them, of course, when the older brother says to Damien, you'll be executed at dawn. That's the first time Damien hears it. That was the first time Killian heard it. First time he hears it. I didn't give him that bit of the scene, because he thought he'd come. The intention was he'd just come to ask him to tell the people to lay down their arms. It's in the Civil War. I mean, there are two brothers, so it's in the Civil War. One is fighting on the treaty side, the one is fighting on the Republican, what they call the Republican side. The pro-treaty side won, and the Were brothers did tear families apart. But finding that moment, but it meant also, it meant for the older brother, he had to carry that. I said to him, he doesn't know what you're going to say. So he had to carry that burden with him, playing the scene, knowing that he'd got to say it. And that, in a way, is part of the weight. I don't have to say anything to him about that, but that's the weight he's carrying.
Yeah. People must have said this to you before, and I don't want it to be an extended diversion, interesting though it would be, but as you will be aware, in Elizabethan theatre, actors were given their roles, and that their, so in Shakespeare and his contemporaries, the playing company, which was a very expensive thing to be given a role, because it involved using a piece of paper effectively. So you certainly wouldn't write out the entire play for any one actor. So they got what they were gonna say, and then a few cue words that they needed to be ready to hear and respond to, so that process of being surprised by the action of the play as one goes into a first short rehearsal is recognisable across Elizabethan theatre. But let us not go that interesting, though it would be. Mm. Place matters a lot in this film, and that there's the farmhouse that we start at, that we've just seen, where the raid happens, or the brutality happens, and it's part of the process for Damien, the central character, of thinking how he's going to respond to this kind of challenge on his community. And at first he thinks he's going to leave it, and that eventually he decides he's going to not leave it and participate in a collective struggle. And it starts there, and the film also ends at the same farmhouse. But the farmhouse that we had first met, and in fact just shortly before that scene, they've just been playing hurling, as you said, and it's a kind of place of togetherness and of camaraderie and of singing and actually kind of cross class as well. So you've got an ironmonger and a trainee doctor there, and that they're all playing hurling together, and it's competitive manly pursuits that is going to be horribly translated into a very different kind of competitive manly pursuit in due course. But then it's going to end up back at that same farmhouse that in the meantime has been burnt. And it has Sinead, all of Fitzgerald, whom we saw in the scene there, knelt in front of it in ruins. Her life is now in ruins, and the farmhouse behind her is in ruins. And it's the camera pulls back, I think, a little bit as the character who's just delivered the letter, delivering the awful news that her true love has just been shot. And it's a beautifully composed shot. And it is eloquent in the kind of punch that it packs. And that I could imagine a different filmmaker would milk that shot And you are very light touch on it and off, even though we feel farmhouse is this kind of bookending sense of where the film has been and of potential for togetherness and utter desecration of what togetherness could possibly mean by the end. How disciplined do you have to be in order not to go, oh, I've got a good one in frame now? How long will I give it to an audience for?
Well, it's a judgment, really. I mean, it's the same judgment throughout the film. This just has to be consistent. I think it's to do with treating an audience as adults. I mean, I hate sentimentality, and I hate the, you know, when the violins swoop in and try and milk the tears, and it's just bad faith with the audience, I think. You know, it's not tragic because the violins come in. It's tragic because of what we've seen, the potential that those people have. And also, their characters, particularly Damien, I mean, he's a character with, as you said, committed to life. He's going to be a doctor. Based on Ernie O'Malley, who's a great Republican in the battle for independence. And he gave that up. So the real quality that would have made him a great doctor for saving lives is the quality that kills him, because he can't give up. You know, he cannot abhor his principles. You know, and it's the same thing that leads him in the end to execute a young lad he's grown up with, because the lad's betrayed them. And mm-hmm. It's that firmness of purpose that would have made him a wonderful doctor, and I guess a wonderful partner in life, and at the same time destroys him.
And the human costs of that are clear. I don't feel anything anymore in his final letter. I think Teddy is nearly dead inside already or something. He says that actually it's been in a process in which, actually let's just use this as a bounce into I, Daniel Blake, because I, Daniel Blake, which sounds all about agency and asserting something, the title even, about being individually present and the significance of the individual, as opposed to the wind that shakes the barley, that feels like it sort of forces that are bigger than the individual. Yes. Just probably most people will have seen I, Daniel Blake, but perhaps you could just briefly set up for us what the film is about.
Yes, it's a story of Daniel Blake. Is a man in his early 60s. He should be due to retire as a carpenter, but he can't work because he's had a heart attack and his doctors have told him he must not work. The work capability assessment introduced under this government, or since 2010 or before that, but is a punitive action because it civil or people are hired to interview people who claim to be sick, and override their doctors, their consultants, and say, no, we don't care what the medical profession say, we say you're fit for work. If they don't look for work, then their benefits get chopped. Daniel strikes a friendship with a young woman, Katie, who's from London, but she can't get housing there, so she's sent north to the northeast, where rents are cheaper, and she's given a house there, and she finds she's there with two kids and no family support, and they become friends and support each other. Katie again has a benefits cut because she was late for the appointment of the job centre, because she didn't know how to get there. Nevertheless, they cut her benefits. To get food, she goes to a food bank. She's been starving her. She's been eating minimal stuff so the kids get food. And in the end, in desperation, she goes to a food bank. And Daniel takes her there because she won't know where it is. He takes her there, and she goes to get a bag of food. She hasn't eaten probably for half a week. That's important to know. I mean, we know that in the film, but you won't know just from the clip. And we pick it up, I think, where they're just going into the food bank. And what struck us, and I hope you maybe folks will keep an eye for this, is the absolute humanity and care of the volunteers. And these are real volunteers in the food bank who are in the scene. And the people in the food bank, apart from Katie and Dan, are people who use food banks.
Okay, let's watch the scene. Thank you.
Have you brought your little dog today? Thank you very much. Thank you. So just brought for yourself and the two children, Katie. Thank you. The two children have a drink of juice and a biscuit. Would you like to go and see Agnes? Agnes, could you do juice and a biscuit, please? Jackie?
Yeah?
Would you be able to help Katie with her shopping today, please? Thank you.
Hi, Katie. Don't mind. Thank you. So we've got one adult and two children. Yeah, come with me. We'll start with the vegetables, yeah?
Okay.
Right. I'll give you one side and we'll share it, yes?
Anything
we can
do for you,
hon?
No, I'm fine, thanks.
Are you sure?
Fine.
Aye, all right.
Aye,
then. Please,
yeah.
You just moved up here, your accent's not from here, you know, a Georgian.
Yeah, been up for a little while, just come up from London.
Right, nice accent. Can you understand the Georgians?
Almost.
Right, over here.
I think we need another bag.
Never got one.
No. Where's something? It's a
well, I'll just keep going in with stuff and then you tell me what
that's
you don't need,
have you got any sanitary?
I don't have sanitary towels. All right,
not to worry.
Don't really donate them much like that. Yeah. A shame. You should. Right, Race, if you open your bag. Race? And a couple of toilet rolls?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll go to the food, it's falling out of my bag. I'll put this in. Right. Tins and yours, I'll put them in there. Another tin, anything else you want? There you go.
Okay, thank you.
There's pasta sauce over here. I'll get you some pasta sauce. The pasta sauce. And there's a pasta here as well, I'll get you a pasta. Hey, Petra, are you all right? What are you doing? What are you doing?
Come and sit down. It's all right. It's all right. It's all right. Come and sit down. Sit down. It's all right. It's all right. Okay. It's all right.
Sorry.
It's all right. Do you want a drink? Do you want a drink?
Oh, really sorry.
What's the matter?
Thank you. I am... this is a film that has touched very many people, but it's also got up a lot of people's noses. But that rather than leeching time from questions, we won't go into a one-on-one conversation about it now, Ken. I will bow out at this point, having thanking you for talking us through a little bit of the detail about process of some of these harrowing and thought-provoking and significant films. Thank you. And now over to Wes to manage questions. Thank you, Wes.
Okay.
Thank you, Judith.
Judith, you don't need to bow out altogether, but you're welcome to sort of, as it were, take a back seat for now. I've got a whole bunch of interesting questions that have come through. And in fact, I'll take the last one first because it relates directly to Daniel Blake. And it's a comment from Kempton Rees, who's an alum of St. Peter's, said, "Good evening, Ken. Thank you so much for your time." He says, "I confess to going to see I, Daniel Blake with some trepidation. I'm a part-time tribunal judge who hears ESA and PIP appeals. My fear was that when it came to the appeal hearing, the hero would be faced with a row of pompous, uncaring, bow-tied idiots, whereas that is not my experience at all." And there's a bracket, for those who don't know, disability appeals are decided by a panel of two or three, including the judge. So here's the question, Ken. It was such a relief to find out that the majority of characters who represented the state in this film showed real humanity. I loved the film and the opening passage in particular. My question is, what research did you do? No doubt extensive. Did you attend a tribunal? And if so, what was your experience?
We did a lot of research, mainly Paul Laverty did most of this legwork, but I went with him quite a lot. We were in the job centres, really. So everybody worked, we talked to a lot of people who had worked in job centres and still did work in job centres through the, mainly we found them through the union, the PCS. And we listened to their stories, and we listened obviously to people who had been to using job centres, and they told us everything. The character wouldn't have gone to a tribunal in that storyline. I mean, he just got the information he was sanctioned or not. Mm-hmm. And the same for Katie. So the tribunal didn't really arise, but I'm interested to hear the comments.
I suppose what it raises is a larger question, drawing on something that you said in your discussion with Judith about common humanity and also solidarity with the characters. Mm-hmm. And the degree to which, if you like, there are goodies and baddies, to put it very straightforwardly, in your film. And it doesn't seem to me that there are, and it doesn't seem to me that the question here, that somewhere that's not the kind of filmmaker that you are. Could you say a bit more about that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the people in job centres, they're not to blame. They're there. So many of them said, we were there as long as we could stand it because we needed the money. We were desperate. It was our job. Mm-hmm. Some left. One man who'd worked for the union never got promoted, that he obviously his seniority should have given him. But it's, you know, you don't go for the monkeys when it's the organ grinders that are causing the trouble. And I mean, it's Duncan Smith, you know, and his the gang, the whole clique of them who put in these draconian measures that trap people. And, you know, the key thing is that when appeals were made, and most of them were successful. Because the government calculated if they put in a whole load of sanctions, a lot of people wouldn't have the energy, they wouldn't have the determination, they wouldn't have the know-how how to appeal. And they relied on that. And that's the cynicism of it that makes you so angry. And then they knew they were using hunger as a weapon, are using hunger as a weapon, because they know the food banks expanded. Why did they expand? Most of the people said it's a problem with sanctions. Mm-hmm. So to take money away from people who have nothing, you are telling them you can go hungry, you know? And if that doesn't make us angry, I don't know what should.
So there's two questions from Samir, one a technical one and one a sort of one that flows directly from what you've just said. Samir asked, do you think that Britain has changed for the better or for worse since the time of Kathy Come Home? In other words, you've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And how has, if you do think Britain has changed in one or other direction, has that affected the way in which you approach your own work?
Yeah, I've made a mistake in the last question. Of course, of course he does go for a tribunal. His appeal finally comes through.
Yeah.
And he's waiting to go into the tribunal when he goes to the loo, and then he has a heart attack and dies. So I was wrong on that. My memory is...
It's nice to know that somebody can forget even their own story. Yeah. But anyway...
Yeah. Remind me of the new question.
So the new question is... effectively, you've been doing this for a long time. All the way back to Kathy Come Home. Yeah. Has Britain got better or worse over that time?
Well,
and the secondary question is, does that change affect your own work as a filmmaker? Do you change with the times, if you like?
That's a complicated answer. But the essence is that when we did Kathy Come Home and Kes and that in the 60s, we were still in the aftermath of the post-war settlement. We still had the welfare state. The National Health Service was not riddled with private companies and subcontractors. There was still a programme of council housing. The social security system, not benefits, social security, was there to protect people. Yes, there was a housing issue, as we tried to share in Kathy, but no one foresaw Margaret Thatcher and the decade that followed her, decade in which the welfare state began to be torn apart. And of course, that tearing apart continued under Tony Blair and has continued in spades ever since. So that's the big change. So it's a change of culture. It's a change of consciousness. I mean, in the 60s and before, you know, when I was growing up, the war had been won. There was a sense of collective consciousness of how we supported each other. That consciousness disappeared, prompted by the economic changes of the 80s. And that's the shift. That's the big shift. And yes, poverty has got worse and desperation has got worse. Of course, there are medical advances. Of course, there are, you know, people have washing machines where we didn't, or they may have a television where we didn't, and things like that. Yes, of course, one can say get better. But the sense of community, the sense of mutual interdependence, of mutual solidarity, of an economic system which at least can look towards justice and social justice, that's gone. It's the individual, and that's the big change. In terms of filmmaking, well, maybe it's the stories you tell change, really. That's what happens. And the response to them changes. But the process doesn't change. It's still the process of an observer who tries to see what is really in people's minds and hearts.
Thank you. I've got another question just on this line, and then we'll move to a sort of more formal set of questions, because there's two kinds of questions coming through, if you like. Okay. Steve says, much of your work has been sharply current. Two of my favourites, says Steve, are the historical pieces, Bali and Land and Freedom. Mm-hmm. So what prompted you to make these films at these particular times?
The historical ones are the big events that were changed politics, the Spanish Civil War, for example. That was the first war against fascism from which Britain stood aside. Only 3 years before the start of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Fascists got in, took over the government in Spain. The British Foreign Office, we understand, gave them a helping hand. So it puts into some context our attitudes, the state attitude to fascism. Mm-hmm. But also it was about the splits on the left, the split between Stalinists and Social Democrats, who were by and large for accepting the status quo, just getting rid of the fascists, and for the revolutionaries who wanted a new society altogether. And that conflict is central to the labor movement and its history. Mm-hmm. The Irish Civil War, again, was to say, look, the Irish War is not about the British intervening in Ireland to stop the Irish killing themselves. This was a colonial struggle for independence from an occupying power mm-hmm. that had been there for centuries. Mm-hmm. So rewriting that, and we were called, I didn't have time to say this, I mean, we got the most appalling abuse for that. We were called in the Times columnist a worse propagandist than Leni Riefenstahl. Mm-hmm. Now, Leni Riefenstahl was Hitler's propagandist.
Yep.
A man called Heffer in the Telegraph wrote, I don't want to see the film because I don't need to read Mein Kampf to know what a louse Hitler was. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the right-wing press when you challenge their view of history. Mm-hmm. And the abuse and the intemperate language that is used when you challenge people's power happens whenever you become involved in politics on issues like that.
Yep.
And it's dangerous.
Yeah. There's a question from Kenneth Kenneth says Ken, which is kind of in a way following on from what you've just said, which is, what was the response? Could you tell us a bit more about the response of the local County Cork community to the story that you were recalling from their past?
Oh, they were terrific. I mean, they couldn't have been more warm. I mean, in fact, we don't make a lot of fuss when we're filming. You know, we try and move about fairly unobtrusively. And we were in the countryside for most of it. But by and large, they were very supportive. Particularly amongst the academics, you know, we had some academics who worked with us and, mm-hmm. you know, detailed historical details and their knowledge, and they were very supportive. But the people, you start smiling once you get off the plane, you know, whatever. Terrific people, lovely place. Try the Beamish start.
Going back to the question of sort of the danger, another question that's just come in is, how difficult is it for you to get your films financed?
Well, we've been lucky. I mean, there was a period in the 70s when, after Kes and a film called Family Life, we couldn't do cinema films at all. And they were the Carry-Ons or or worse. I mean, I quite like the Carry-Ons, but we obviously weren't that. It was only American films. The 80s were a very difficult time because although Channel 4 began and making films, it wasn't an easy time for people of, you know, where I stood and people like me stood. We were certainly not flavour of the month. So I did two films, that one film in the 80s, and I did it was a good script, but my work was poor on it. I didn't do well. Mm-hmm. That was my fault. And then we started again, we got films made again via Channel 4, that was okay. And then with Land and Freedom, we worked with European co-producers, mm-hmm. and that's been the model.
Yeah.
And because of money, our biggest audience is in France by miles. I mean, there's one example, with The Wind That Shakes the Barley, there were 40 prints in British cinemas. There were over 400 in France.
Yeah.
Over 400. In Ireland, there were 70.
Yeah.
So our finance mainly has come from France and Italy and other European countries and Japan. And that's been rock solid.
That's interesting. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt. But that's interesting partly because as we were talking about before we came on air, as it were, I've got a picture of Fassbinder in the background. And I wondered whether European, you clearly are greatly celebrated, for example, in France, where I often work and I'm a French professor. I just wondered whether whether this is a question also from Louise, actually, which I'll frame in the terms that she puts forward, which is which directors were responsible for your political film education? And I'll gloss it, British ones or European ones, or who were they?
European ones, not for the political education. That came from political engagement, really, in the 60s, seeing through the Labour government of Harold Wilson when I delivered pamphlets for him, and then 2 years later you saw that he didn't mean any change at all. And then there were political movements there, and that was when I really learned and met people who were actively engaged in politics, and you learn and you live in the world and you see how it operates. The film influences were stylistic, and also saying that working class life is a fit subject for films. Mm-hmm. That last one was the Italian neorealists of the 50s, the post-war period, mm-hmm. De Sica particularly, the obvious one is Bicycle Thieves.
You know? Yep.
That was a great favourite. But their importance to us was saying, this is a fit subject for the cinema.
Yeah.
This is okay. You can do this. It doesn't have to be about posh people in smart apartments.
Yeah.
The stylistic ones were the Czech filmmakers, mm-hmm. Miloš Forman, Jiří Menzel of the Velvet Revolution, again in the 60s. And if you want to watch a couple of wonderful films, A Blonde in Love by Miloš Forman and Closely Observed Trains by Jiří Menzel, lovely films, make you smile, touch you, are very human mm-hmm. and beautiful.
Come and study them all here at Oxford University in the European film course.
But good.
I suppose if we could turn, now we are effectively now turning to form and to just two or three questions towards the end. One is about music. You mentioned your kind of common musical composer who's worked with you sort of a good deal, George Fenton. And the sort of larger question is, how do you use music in your field, in your films? Because in the discussion you talked about disliking when the violins come in, but nonetheless there is, if you like, extra diegetic, there is music that complements the mood in your films. How do you make those decisions?
It's a series of knots. You must not use music to make up for the deficiencies of the film. The film has to, the action and what is said and the people should engage you without having to resort to music. If you've got to use music to make it more exciting, that's a failure. So, our attitude to music, and that's developed over the years really, is just to give you another perspective. I mean, for example, you might be doing a scene that is really a microcosm of something. This has happened once or twice with George. And the scene is a microcosm, that is that relates to a huge issue across society, across the country, across the world, or other countries, or whatever. And music can say, look, this is something very precise and in this man's eyes, or this little group, but actually there's a wider significance, and it can be the equivalent of a much wider shot. It says this is, mm-hmm. there's something eternal about this that you're watching, even though it is absolutely precise and particular to these characters.
Yeah.
And so it's that sense of another perspective, I think.
Yeah.
That it has to be very careful, because if you use it sparingly, as we've been doing, if it comes in and you notice it, then you undermine the film. So yeah. I mean, George has said, it's harder to write two notes at the end than a full score, mm-hmm. for that reason.
I wonder if, again, following on from this idea of the sort of particularity of the moment, the gesture, the word, and the larger picture, Lucas has said, to what extent do you find directing in another language presents difficulties? Is responding to gesture and expression enough in these contexts? I think they're thinking particularly about Land and Freedom.
No, it's very difficult. I mean, that's why we had to do it through the eyes of an international group, not the international brigades, because they hadn't arrived then, but of an international group of volunteers. And then there were all languages, and some of it is in Spanish, quite a bit in Spanish, but yeah. I really struggled on that. And I had to have someone muttering in my ear what they're saying, and someone who is sensitive to if a word, you know, had a slightly different connotation from a literal translation, mm-hmm. that I was aware of it. And when we were cutting it, we had Rosanna Pastor came and sat in the cutting room with us as we were, and she was saying, well, he actually means that. He doesn't mean what you think he means. Mm-hmm. So that it absolutely had to rely, but it's very difficult. Most difficult part of it all is to know what word to say to trigger a response from the actor. Because you say the wrong word, you can throw people right off. That's really difficult. But almost everybody in the cast had some English. So we got by on in that way.
And am I right in thinking that a good few of the cast members in Land and Freedom Again were quote unquote amateur actors?
I'd never say amateur actors.
No, okay, that's why I put it in quotations. Yeah. So, but one of the questions is here, how difficult is it then to work with, okay, what do we say if it's not amateur actors? People who aren't trained actors.
Inexperienced, yeah. You treat them all the same, exactly the same. The actors with big experience, and I've worked some with a lot of experience, like Peter Mullen and Killian, obviously, Robert Carlyle, Ricky Tomlinson, and, you know, lots of experience. But actually, treat everyone the same. The ones who know how films work, just by how they are, they communicate that to the others, not by saying anything. And they also, from the people whose life experience might connect to the part they're doing, they become a form of reference. You know, well, how would you do this? Or what's, if you're actually a pro at the job, how do you manage this? Or so that, again, but more by a process of osmosis than anybody saying it.
You have to do fewer takes or more takes.
No, it doesn't affect it at all. Doesn't affect it at all. Because you practice little things like that without them knowing you're practicing it.
Right. Okay. I've got two more questions for you. It's already nearly 5 past, but let's carry on for another 5 minutes. One is a kind of quasi-technical question, although it's not only technical, and that is, what's the difference between making a film for television and a film for the cinema?
When I began, there wasn't really a difference. I mean, I guess it's the essential things are the same. Is this story worth telling? What's the point of it? Is it significant? Is it interesting? Do I care about it? Am I engaged by it at a filmmaking level? And then what's the truth? How do you hammer it out? What's the storyline? And then on the day, have we got everything ready? Where's the light? How can we get it if it's raining? You know, the same things. You might shoot a television film a bit closer because the screen's a bit smaller. You know, you might do that rather than a waist shot.
Yep.
Apart from that, I wouldn't want to make any, but also haven't done a television fiction film for many years. I mean, over 40 years. So I'm not the person to ask. I mean, that was before the Zapper came in.
Yeah, well, I guess that would be another question. Okay, what's the future?
Yeah. Mercifully, I've missed that.
You mentioned Morecambe and Wise when you were talking about your relationship with your writer. I think we can agree that you're not really Morecambe and Wise, not least that your films are not exactly a barrel of laughs. But one question, the last Pratt one perhaps, is that it's from Lucy. Despite examining difficult, often bleak political subjects, your films always seem to me to be quietly hopeful, to find the beauty. Is this something you agree with? And if so, how do you go about this?
Well, thanks, Lucy. I mean, I'm glad you see it too. Absolutely, we see it. I mean, it's the beauty of simple things, isn't it? It's the beauty in an old face as well as a young one. He says, thinking of his own. It's the beauty of little casual things, of you know, the way of simple things, and many, again, it's down to light and framing and how you select them. But it's in hope. It's in people's resilience. The fact people will always fight back. You know, that's the hope. It's the hope that if you're in trouble, don't go to a rich area, go to a poor one, because that's where people always help each other. And it's comedy, you know. If you want to laugh, don't go with wealthy people, go and stand in the bar where it's just ordinary folks, because you'll hear laughter. And it's genuine laughter, and there's a warmth to the humour. And people, you know, sometimes say, well, why do you put jokes in? Well, life's full of jokes, you know, and the harsher the situation, often the sharper the jokes, really, or just the sense of humour. Mm-hmm. And people smile, and people do daft things, and wear funny clothes, they just do silly things without knowing it. And so that sense of humour, the sense of warmth, the sense of friendship, comradeship, solidarity, mutual support, even, you know, even when there's great oppression, as in the Irish film, you know, even when there's an occupying army beating you to death and taking your land and whatever, there's moments of gentleness and moments as Judith was kind enough to say, I mean, there's moments of tenderness and care, and that's what gives you hope, isn't it? It's the generosity of spirit that most people have, and the sense of justice that most people have, and the determination to fight back, and that's what gives you hope.
Thank you. I'll end with a comment, which is takes us in a way back to the St. Peter's side of things. It's a comment from Charlie. Can you above anyone make me proud to be a St. Peter's alumnus? I, Daniel Blake, was the last film to bring me to tears. Thank you for consistently striving to represent the stories of the unrepresented and those left behind. I think if it's okay, we'll stop on that comment unless you particularly want to add anything else.
No, I just want to say thank you. I had some wonderful moments at St. Peter's when it was St. Peter's Hall. And the warmth and friendship when I've been back is as generous as it was then. So it's always a huge privilege to come back. And thank you for that.
I think that should bring us to the end of our time and end of our discussion this evening. So thank you to both Judith for making this happen, and to Ken. Thank you to all our viewers at home for watching. I should say this event would not have been possible without the support from many others behind the screens, including the Torch team. I extend my thanks to all of them as well. But for now, I think Judith has disappeared from our screens, but thank you, Judith. And also thank you, Ken, and goodbye.
Thank you.
We do hope that you, our viewers, will join us again for future We hope that you, our viewers, will join us again for future Big Tent live events over the coming weeks as we continue to bring together researchers, students, and creative artists from across different disciplines to explore some of the important subjects in the humanities. I've also been asked to point out that St. Peter's will be hosting a public event on March the 1st, in which Dr. Suzanne Hodgson will be reporting on another important event for humanity, namely some of her work on the Oxford vaccine trials. For now, thank you all for joining us, and goodbye for now. Thank you.